You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Risky Business by Michelle Thompson. U.S. officials and at least one of DASAC's former colleagues were stunned when in November 2020, the WHO announced the names of 11 international experts assigned to a fact-finding mission to China to investigate COVID-19's origins. China had veto power over the list, and none of the three candidates put forward by the U.S. had made the cut. Instead, DASAC was listed as America's sole representative. It's still unclear how DASAC wound up on the commission. DASAC told Vanity Fair, "WHO reached out to me and asked me to serve on the committee. I initially refused, but following their persuasive arguments, decided that it was my duty as a scientist to support the Origins investigation." A WHO spokesperson would neither confirm nor deny DASAC's account. One former Echo Health staffer thinks it's obvious who tapped DASAC for the role. If his name was not among the names floated by the U.S., his was the name that the Chinese government chose. On March 24, 2021, DASAC presented a confidential preview of the WHO mission's findings to a group of federal health and national security officials in a packed government conference room. Dressed in a tweed jacket instead of his usual hiking gear, he clicked through a 36-slide presentation which Vanity Fair obtained. Amid the charts, graphs, and old photos from the Wuhan market of caged animals that could have harbored the virus, there was one slide devoted to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. It seemed to suggest that the questions swirling around the laboratory as a possible source of the pandemic could be put to rest. There had been annual external audits with no unusual findings. Access was strictly controlled, and his trusted partner, Xi Jingli, said there had been no COVID-19-like illnesses among her staff. The WHO Commission released its 120-page final report a year later. The experts had voted, by a show of hands, that while transmission through an intermediate animal was likely to, very likely, transmission through a laboratory incident was extremely unlikely. The report was so error-riddled and unpersuasive that WHO Director General Tedros effectively disowned it the day it was released. As far as WHO is concerned, all hypotheses remain on the table, he said. DASAC himself all but admitted in a letter to Dr. Michael Lauer, the NIH's deputy director for extramural research, that he had signed on to the WHO mission with a personal and professional agenda to gather exculpatory information about the WIV, in part to help lift the curtain of suspicion around his grant so it could be reinstated. He wrote that while he had acted in good faith to follow the WHO's directives for the mission, he had also gathered essential information that specifically addresses one of the NIH's demands, that he arrange for an outside inspection team to find out if the WIV had SARS-CoV-2 in its possession prior to December 2019. He'd returned with categorical statements from WIV senior staff that they did not, he wrote, and had managed to get them included in the WHO final report. Unfortunately for DASAC, The NIH was unmoved. The grant remains suspended today. On February 25th, 2022, a day before Rorabe, Anderson, Gary, and their 15 co-authors rushed their preprints into the public domain, claiming dispositive evidence that SARS-CoV-2 originated from the Huanan market, China's CDC published a preprint of its own that contained new data and pointed to a different conclusion. It revealed that of the 457 swabs taken from 18 species of animals in the market, none contained any evidence of the virus. Rather, the virus was found in 73 swabs taken from around the market's environment, all linked to human infections. Thus, while the samples proved the market served as an amplifier of viral spread, they did not prove the market was the source. Meanwhile, an analysis published on March 16th in the medical journal BMJ Global Health, written by a group of Italian scientists and co-authored by Sergei Pond, cites a growing body of studies indicating that the virus may have been spreading worldwide for weeks, or even months, before the officially recognized start date of December 2019. If true, this would entirely upend the presumption of the market as the genesis of the pandemic. There are still a lot of credible questions that have not been answered, says Pond. And with no overwhelming evidence in either direction, he adds, he is puzzled as to why it's necessary to push in one direction. Responding to written questions, Anderson said, I have no particular stake in the idea that SARS-CoV-2 came from the market and not from virology research. The science speaks for itself, and the evidence is clear. Simon Wayne Hobson has his own hypothesis for what is taking place. The group of scientists pushing the claim of natural origin, he says, want to show that virology is not responsible for causing the pandemic. That is their agenda. For this article, additional research by Rebecca Aiden and Stan Friedman. Thank you. the Great Resistance. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has spawned death and horror, countered by a nationwide uprising that stands strong in the face of an increasingly dystopian war. Photographs by Alex Majoli. Essay by Katya Petroskaya. Opening photo, still standing. Fortifications surround Odessa's Opera House, an iconic landmark in the Black Sea city, as Russia's bloody war unfolds. As I write, 6 weeks have passed since the war began. We are starting to adjust. The death of a person becomes a statistic. It is impossible to adjust. We are watching the war online. The stories we encounter are emerging as if out of a ripped belly, multifaceted grief without hierarchy. They block any means of perception. How to bear it? The young woman from Mariupol who was rescuing others, killed. Wounded people. Huge halls in Poland filled with refugees and their pets. Children in Kharkiv living in the subway. The ghost buildings of Odessa. Ruins everywhere. My writing cannot protect a single person under the bombs. A single house. The war is quicker than any speech against it. Today, I again woke up at 5:07 a.m. as if from an explosion or an air raid siren. The exact time the war started on February 24th. Each time upon waking, I hope that this war is my personal nightmare. It takes a few seconds for evidence to break through. O is killed. M is killed. N is killed. A is killed. The skeletons of charred houses hurt me from the inside. I cannot grasp the war. I have to stop it. I am in Berlin, and thousands of people are arriving every day from Ukraine to the main railway station. They don't want to be called refugees. They are homeless, mostly women and children, the men left behind. Their future is uncertain. They are looking for the next step. The family from Mariupol was euphoric, still not believing that they were alive in Europe, trying to feed me with everything that had just been donated to them. A very old man from a village near Zaporizhia held both my hands. His daughter did not want to leave, but forced him and her mother to go. A small girl from Kharkiv, jumping around and saying, "Papa did this," or "Papa did that." Her mother, silent. That family from Hostomel, I had promised to help them. A father and his disabled son. But I forgot to come back and lost them in the crowd. Now, my mother, a child of World War II, has made it to Berlin. She taught history her whole life. Back in 1941, she, a six-year-old girl, had to leave Kyiv for the Urals, fleeing the German army. Now she has fled Kyiv for Germany, escaping the Russian army. It is perhaps the smallest absurdity of this war. Whatever I do, my thoughts are in Mariupol, a city that before the war was home to more than 400,000 inhabitants. I try to imagine so many people starving, under bombs, trying to flee, unable to bury their dead, bombed again, dying while I am writing, dying while Western leaders debate and hesitate. Mariupol already recalls the siege of Leningrad and the Battle of Stalingrad in one. We don't dare to imagine the scale of devastation caused by the Russian army. And yet, we know enough to say that this army, trained in Grozny and Aleppo, now turns its atrocities on Ukraine, all of them, encyclopedically. A few weeks ago, I asked one high-ranking military expert, how many dead civilians does the West need in order to start acting? He said, it might sound cynical, but we need pictures. Bukha, Irpin, Vorzel, a trio of small satellites around Kyiv. I saw the pictures at night, a palm and smashed faces peeking out from brown soil, the hand of a dead woman with a professional red manicure, a mass grave, some 300 bodies, others lying along the street with tied hands, in fashionable shoes, tortured, shot. The street was newly repaved. Bukha had been getting richer. Lootings, reports of mass rape, the killing of whole families. My brain refuses to understand. My body goes through withdrawal. I went to Bukha in the summer as a child. In recent years, visiting Kyiv, I joined friends there. My university classmate Taras has a big family in Bukha. They all gather in summer on the lake to make huge pots of plov, to swim and to sing, to stroll through grass taller than we are. Friends of friends, musicians, kids, slightly hippie-like, one of the sweetest gatherings I ever experienced. Danila played bagpipes. I picture them all in my head at once and shiver. Taras wrote the next day. His relatives are out of Bukha, spread across Europe, safe. The mother of one of my friends in Berlin is also safe after 2 weeks in a cellar in Bukha, discovering now in the pace of everyday life who is and is not alive among her neighbors. The violence is spreading everywhere where people just used to live, further, unpredictable. My friend, a photographer, met a woman in a village on the road to Kyiv. She was watching cars pass by as if she were waiting for something. She had spent her life teaching Russian language and literature. Now she had lost her only son. Russian soldiers had taken a few men to repair their machinery, treated them politely, and then killed them all. Russia misuses Ukrainian war victims for propaganda in order to kill more people and to indulge further killing, justifying the newly killed as a premise to kill even more. Everything that does not help to break the pace of this war seems hollow to me. We know this dystopian nature of dictatorship. It reproduces death. How many times have we thought about what could have been done to stop Hitler, had one acted in time? Had people believed in their own power and the need to resist for the sake of the others? Now we think of this war. It is too late to think in the subjunctive. Accepting our powerlessness, we accept their violence. From the first days, work became for many a method of resistance to war, became a proof of existence, since the mere idea of sovereign existence is questioned. Not just the Ukrainian army and territorial defense forces, the whole country is working like a beehive. Concrete support for people fighting, for people helping to help. That seems the ultimate choice. Perhaps this is a substitution for hope, to act. No normal life, only frenetic actions. It is not only because horror would swallow you if you were to stop. It is the decentralized initiative of survival. People are creating new supply systems and information networks, organizing evacuations, cooking for the army, buying medicine and supplying those who remain in occupied zones, rescuing pets and protecting monuments. This irrefutable enthusiasm reminds me of the Spanish Civil War. The chain of deeds in a common endeavor has spread across Europe and beyond, and I am also a part of it. There is no time to tell the stories, to tell others what we all are actually doing. For the first few weeks, we lived in a tempo of orders. There are thousands of such groups emerging sporadically. But there is so much grief that even helping all the time, you cannot heal the wounds. The war lasts and multiplies calamities. This merciless knowledge inevitably makes witnesses out of us. I wonder, who is this we? We Ukrainians? We who live in Europe? Anyone who agrees that Putin has to be defeated by all means? We can admire those who are fighting, feel compassion with those who suffer. We who sometimes experience powerlessness. Others can pretend that this war has nothing to do with them. But the Russian war has already changed the order of things, exposed the vulnerability of the most powerful world organizations. The war could be stopped by a common act of resistance. But so much depends nowadays on how we define this we. Expanding it beyond the institutions and methods that have proven themselves insufficient. Spring has come, and people's wish to return to Ukraine grows even stronger. My mom, my friends, people I met at Berlin's train station, so many want to go home, even if there is no home left. I could never have expected that our life would once turn as simple as a folk song, to chase away the enemy, to reunite with loved ones, to touch the soil, to enter the apartment, to plant, to mourn, to see the orchards blossoming, to go back to work, to rebuild, or just to visit the place you came from. Simple, hardly reachable things. In the photos, Warpath. Ukrainians are coming in to protect their country. Here, young volunteers move anti-tank to the eastern force of Odessa in preparation for attacks. A Russian missile strike on a military base in Mykolaiv claimed the lives of dozens of Ukrainian soldiers. Firing line. Volunteers in Odessa receive training in firearms as Russia's full-scale invasion grows. Last rites. Sergei Belogarev, 29, is laid to rest following an attack on the military base of Varshnaksk. Safe haven. Millions of people, many of them children, have fled Ukraine since Russia invaded, with more displaced inside the country. Now for the Vanity Fair Awards Insider, a special section dedicated to the TV stars and creators who keep us riveted, streaming, and dreaming, featuring Squid Game, photographs by AB&DM. Opening remarks. The new TV landscape is complicated and often maddening, but the rewards are great. Too many television shows on too many devices is a good problem to have. If you don't agree, talk to someone who spent their childhood using a hanger for a TV antenna and a pair of pliers to change channels, all just to watch Eight is Enough. Yes, the streaming age has been overwhelming. And yes, it's been expensive. So we figure out which platforms we need in perpetuity and which we can cancel and resubscribe to whenever there's a new season of their one good show. Still, the industry that kept us wrapped and informed in lockdown continues to deliver miracles. This is Vanity Fair's third annual TV issue. We tried to capture television as we see it right now and to track its evolution. Recently, there was a legitimate fear that audiences were watching too many different things for widespread conversations. But as you'll see here, thrilling shows have made a mark. Our O'Quan dives into the making and meaning of global phenom Squid Game. Photographer Nick Riley Bentham shoots stars from The Dropout, Euphoria, Yellowstone, and more. And Joy Press has tea with Matthew McFadyen, whose delicious drama Succession is to pettiness and treachery what Ted Lasso is to being super nice. Not long ago, it wouldn't have been unreasonable to say that the network sitcom was doomed. Young viewers devoured ancient glories like Friends and Seinfeld on streaming services, while new broadcast shows struggled to connect. Now ABC has scored with Abbott Elementary, a gentle comedy about teachers at a Philadelphia school that borrows its winking mockumentary device from past darlings like The Office, while incorporating the perpetual optimism of Coach Lasso. CBS has watched the steady rise of Ghost, a zany haunted house comedy closer to the tartness of Liz Lemon than to Leslie Knope's aggressive sunshine. And in a savage irony, some streamers are now imitating network TV after trouncing it in the revolution. Streamers have even begun dropping episodes of some shows on a weekly basis, like broadcast networks or old-school HBO. Is the all-at-once binge-happy dump headed for extinction? Probably not. But the weekly model has given shows a real chance to take hold. Showtime's mesmerizing mystery box Yellowjackets, for instance, swelled in the zeitgeist after a quiet beginning. You'll find it in these pages, along with dozens of other series that deserve Emmy attention. Some will be favorites of yours, some won't, but there's no denying the scope of what's out there. And anyway, as you've probably heard, love is blind. The backstory, the rise of the tromcom, childhood cancer, alcoholism, humiliation, and death become the stuff of wistful comedy by Rebecca Ford, with illustrations by Ryan McCamus showing Vanessa Bayer and Amy Schumer. In Life and Beth, Amy Schumer's almost 40-year-old character Beth never takes off her bra, even in the most intimate moments. Soon, it's revealed that her hang-up stems from a mortifying teenage memory, one pulled straight from Schumer's life. It was so humiliating and painful, she tells Vanity Fair, and it just kind of stuck with me. So much of Hulu's Life and Beth, which Schumer created, co-wrote, and stars in, is inspired by the actor's own experiences, from teenage cruelty to the strained relationship with her mother and her own battle with the hair-pulling disorder, trichotillomania. But the series is also funny, finding laughter in those painful, messy memories. As the landscape of television has opened up over the past few years, confessional shows from the minds of singular creators like Michaela Coel's I May Destroy You, Issa Rae's Insecure, and Phoebe Waller-Bridge's Fleabag have brought personal stories to the screen that feel both unique to the voices that created them and relatable to a wide audience. "That stuff, it's so brutal," says Schumer. "But after writing about it and talking about it and then shooting it, I don't know, it really feels like I've processed it." Schumer's stand-up has often revealed parts of her past and personal life, as did her 2016 book, The Girl with the Lower Back Tattoo. But turning her life into fiction with Life and Beth, she even felt nervous about the crew would think watching former humiliations play out. That felt kind of vulnerable, just knowing that the thought would pass through their heads of, "Oh, she went through this. How true is this?" she says. Then, again, she was too busy directing 4 of the 10 episodes to linger much longer on it. "It's not like everybody's thinking about me. Everyone's thinking about lunch and doing a good job or, like, their own lives." Vanessa Bayer, who wrote her battle with childhood cancer into her new show, I Love That For You, agrees that there's comedy in trauma and brings that balance of dark and light to the series about a woman who dreams of becoming a home shopping network host. Like Bayer, the character had cancer in her youth and suffers from a bit of arrested development, still trying to figure out how to be a grown-up and have an adult relationship. Next illustrations, Bridget Everett from Somebody Somewhere and Simone Finch from Single Drunk Female. The half-hour Showtime comedy, which Bayer co-created with Jeremy Byler, sees her character Joanna at first attempting to hide her past with cancer from her new co-workers, but then using it in order to keep her new dream job. Bayer says the inspiration came from her own experience of going to college and not being known for her cancer anymore. "It was interesting for me to not be treated with the same kid gloves that I had been treated with in high school, and I think there was a part of me, for sure, that missed that," she says. The series features flashbacks to the character's time in the hospital, and Bayer warned her parents that it might hit close to home. "And I also remind them, this is not you guys," she says. Bridget Everett had no reservations about sharing real aspects of her past in her series Somebody Somewhere, but never wanted to do anything to hurt her family. Created by Hannah Boss and Paul Thurene, the HBO show has its roots in Everett's life, set in her hometown of Manhattan, Kansas, and follows an aspiring singer who has left the big city after her sister's death from cancer. "I'm number one on the call sheet and an executive producer, so it's my job to give as much of myself as I can," says Everett. "You don't really think about, like, oh, 1 million people are going to see this." Everett herself never left city life, but like her character Sam, she lost her sister and was never able to share her music with her. "It was actually kind of wonderful making this show because I've never seen a mental health care professional and probably haven't dealt with her death in the way that I should have," says Everett. "To me, the show is a love letter to her, and it's a love letter to singing and to music." Trauma has long been the stuff of drama and melodrama, but these new dispatches feel fresh and surprising because they're deeply rooted in specificity by their creators. Simone Finch, who created Single Drunk Female based on her own experiences as an alcoholic trying to get sober, wrote her best friend into her show. In the Freeform series, the main character, Samantha, Sophia Black Dahlia, is new to recovery and attempting to repair her friendship with Brit, Sasha Compere, which Finch was never able to do with her real-life friend, whom she hasn't spoken to since 2013. "She never saw me get sober," says Finch. "So writing this was like, what if I had a chance to show Brit that I'm different today than I was then?" Finch started writing when she was still drinking, but the story really came together after she got sober 8 years ago when she was 28. Over the 10-episode first season, the series charts her highest and lowest moments, including Samantha's struggle with the death of her father, broken relationships, and sloppy nights out there for the world to see. "It's scary. I'm not going to lie to you," says Finch. "But in AA, they say you're as sick as your secrets, and I believe that. I don't have to pretend anymore to be anything else." Work-life balance, office space. As more viewers than ever work from home, 5 new series remind us of what we've been missing beneath the fluorescent lights, by David Canfield. Opening photos, Lost Horizon. There's this sense that it's almost like a play office, like a play school office set you'd buy your kids, says Severance's Dan Erickson. It's this mix of the adult world and a childlike world. And government work. I chased some really harsh blues and grays and a lot of high-gloss finishes on the floor to make it feel like Linda has been iced out, says Impeachment's Jamie Walker McCall of the Pentagon set. In Impeachment, American Crime Story, the downfall of a presidency begins in a crappy cubicle. After Sarah Paulson's Linda Tripp is pushed out of her longtime White House job to toil at the Pentagon, we watch the woman who'd later expose Monica Lewinsky's illicit affair with President Bill Clinton stew in her bunker-like 9-to-5 digs and mull revenge. "It's a severe diminishment for this person," says showrunner Sarah Burgess. Adds the FX series production designer Jamie Walker McCall, from the cozy luxury in the White House, she's sent someplace massive and vast, like she's just another number in the system. From the real-life office building friendly of Apple TV Plus's We Crashed to more fantastical imaginings, TV shows set in immaculately designed offices reminded work-from-home audiences of what we've been missing. In Apple TV Plus's sci-fi tale Severance, a company literally severs employees' office memories so they're effectively different people inside its walls. That required a disorienting, claustrophobic workplace design, says creator Dan Erickson, who gave production designer Jeremy Hindel all the creative freedom he needed. "Everything's slightly fractured, just like they all are," says Hindel. "It's beautiful to look at, but it's weird. It's uncomfortable, but it's comfortable, like the whole show." Next photos, call to order. "The space is so conducive to connections between people," says Minxon's Ellen Rappaport. "I liked it feeling aspirational, even though it's pornography." Red alert, every single desk was personalized with photographs and specific material to whatever that writer was supposed to be working on, says Inventing Anna's Henry Dunn. And Hall of Mirrors, arguably the most literal example of this season's office trend, We Crashed, recreation of the rise and fall of WeWork's founders, exactingly replicates the shared office company's lavish headquarters. A sinister beauty also permeates Netflix's Inventing Anna, whose aesthetic is wealthy, VIP, unattainable, high-end New York, according to production designer Henry Dunn. The show is inspired by Jessica Pressler's reporting for New York on wannabe socialite Anna Delvey, and it's set largely in a magazine office with a convincingly lived-in vibe. "We wanted it to feel like the real thing," says Dunn. Another magazine set hit, HBO Max's Minx, invented a nascent 70s pleasure publication for women. Production designer Jefferson Sage shot and crafted nude covers, which helped unlock the series' DIY look for creator Ellen Rappaport. "The models came in and had a great time," she says. "You realized maybe there was this nice, ethical, inclusive porn company in the valley. Maybe not everything in the 70s was gritty and depressing. And maybe every office isn't either." Costume Party, Over the Rainbow, The Essex Serpent, Apple TV+. Claire Danes' character, Cara, cuts a handsome and out-of-place figure striding along a river in Essex, England, as she investigates what locals believe is the return of a deadly sea serpent. Cora is mourning, but not really, an abusive husband, and trying at last to define who she is. So gray, fittingly, is the color of the day. The great Hulu Nicholas Holt's deposed czar, Peter, spends much of the historical comedy's second season on the skids, trying to win back the crown L. Fanning's Catherine stole from him. But he does it in style, sporting statement pieces like this lustrous fur-trimmed coat, just the thing to combat a rough Russian winter. The Good Fight, Paramount Plus. Diane Lockhart, the formidable attorney played by Christine Baranski, first on The Good Wife, and now its streaming sequel, knows a thing or two about wearing a power suit, particularly one in a striking burgundy. The gold brooch helps ensure she'll stand out in the courtroom and just about everywhere else. The Righteous Gemstones, HBO. As profane, pathologically insecure Judy Gemstone, Edie Patterson wears this fittingly jewel-toned satin fuchsia gown to her husband BJ's, Tim Bouts, big post-baptism soiree. Not pictured, BJ's ice-pink formal romper, a garment that must be seen to be believed. The Sex Lives of College Girls, HBO Max. The sunny shade, high neckline and strategic cutouts of this formal but fun sheath epitomize Amrit Kaur's aspiring comedy writer Bella. She's bold and sex positive, but savvy enough not to show too much skin at a stuffy and disillusioning networking event. Winning Time, HBO. In the early 1980s, Magic Johnson's future was as bright as the jerseys the L.A. Lakers wore on the court. Quincy Isaiah sports a perfect replica of that classic uniform in HBO's ebullient dramedy, which chronicles the period in the late 1970s when Jerry Buss, John C. Reilly, bought the franchise and ushered in the Showtime era. Queens, ABC. Brandy's Naomi is at the center of a lot of drama on this juicy soap, which casts the breathy diva as a former hip-hop megastar reuniting with her old bandmates. There's just as much spectacle in the foursome's wardrobe, like this center stage, ready metallic coverall. It's just the sort of flash you'd expect from someone who proudly calls herself a nasty girl. Squid Game, Netflix. If you own a single streaming-enabled device, or even just happen to wander outside last Halloween, you're intimately familiar with the forest green tracksuits foisted upon the desperate contestants, like Oh Young-soo's wily Oil Nam, who have been roped into this South Korean hit's deadly central competition. Ted Lasso, Apple TV+. Did you know that Jason Sudeikis actually plays two characters on Ted Lasso? In the episode pictured here, he introduced Ted Lasso, his ultra-nice coach's ultra-not-nice alter ego. But both wear the same cerulean AFC Richmond warm-up jacket and track pants, which can be accessorized with either a grin or a frown, and a mustache natch. Euphoria, HBO. Perhaps the frilly cropped jacket seen here on Sydney Sweeney's Cassie hasn't single-handedly sparked a gingham craze, but it was a key component of season 2's most talked about and memed scene, in which Cassie's friends devastatingly ask if she's wearing it because she's auditioning for a school production of Oklahoma. The Gilded Age, HBO. Purple is a traditionally royal color, which may be why Danae Benton's aspiring writer Peggy embraces it after trading rural Pennsylvania for bustling nouveau riche New York City. The daring hue also nods toward the character's thoroughly modern ambitions. The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Amazon. While the boisterous comedy's third season officially crossed the barrier into 1960, Midge, Rachel Brosnahan, and her cohort are still donning prim 50s fashion. But Midge's demure trappings belie her spicy onstage persona, played up even more this season by her gig as the opening act at a burlesque club. Hilary Busis wrote these profiles. Television's more memorable costumes cover the full color spectrum, from a Victorian widow's drab duds to a certain inescapable tracksuit. The Vanity Fair Awards Insider will continue in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.